A note before we begin. This episode describes a mass shooting and how one family lived through it. If you have young children listening, you may want to hear it first yourself. This is The Mosaic Mind. I'm Krishnan Iyer. Most episodes of this show are about the things I love: gardens, wine, chocolate, the small discoveries of a curious life. This episode is not like the others. I ask for your patience with it. I'm recording this 2 days after the event it describes, and I'm recording it because I don't know another way to hold it still. Here is where it begins. It is 5:57 on a Sunday evening. I'm standing in a food line at the Bite of Seattle, taking a picture of a banner that says "The Viral Hot Cheeto Balls." I text the picture to my daughter. She has just walked into the Armory building with my wife and my son, so he can use the restroom. She doesn't know I'm in this line. That's the point. Earlier in the day, she had seen the stand. She wanted the deep-fried mac and cheese balls rolled in Cheetos. The line was huge. She didn't want to wait, but I had filed it away. "We know where it is," I thought. "I can get this. Let me stand in line, and I will be holding them when she comes out." She texts back 3 letters. O-M-H. She meant O-M-G. She's a teenager typing fast, and it didn't matter. Nothing was ever going to matter less than 1 letter in a text about cheese. I asked the cashier where he's from. California, it turns out. Working the festival circuit. "They only do pop-ups," he tells me. "No restaurant." I think about the old Bite of Seattle, where you ate something on a paper plate in July and then found the restaurant in November and became a regular and kept a small business alive. There is no November for the hot Cheeto balls. One box of mac and cheese balls, $20. 4 mozzarella sticks, $6. Because my son may not eat the spicy ones. I take out my phone to pay. It is 6 o'clock, or a few seconds after. Hold that moment. I need to tell you how we got there. Not to the festival, to the whole idea of being there. I grew up in Mumbai, where the trains connected everything. Not as a metaphor, as a fact of daily life. The local train was how you got to school, to work, to the sea, to each other. I loved it the way you love a thing that made you. My walk to school in a neighborhood called Mooland took 20 minutes. I have come to understand it was the best education I ever received. In one walk, the railway station, beggars, the richest man in the neighborhood, expensive things and cheap things in adjacent windows, a temple, Ponwallas, sugarcane vendors, the library I borrowed from, the flower shop my friend's father ran, which my friend runs today, produce vendors, oil vendors, silver merchants, kids who lived on the street, running past kids being driven by in a Mercedes, past high rises with gates that opened only for the rich. All of it in the same city. All of it on the same walk. Nobody drilled us for anything at my school. No fire drills. Nothing. The walk was the drill. The world was simply present. All of it, twice a day. Years later, I took my wife and my children back, and we walked that same route. The one I walked for 10 years. My best friend walked it with us. And the two of us narrated our childhood to my kids, shop by shop. So in every city I have ever visited, I have found the trains. Paris, Rome, Milan, New York, Washington, Boston. The buses in New Orleans, because that's what New Orleans had. When the World Cup came to Seattle this summer, I took my son on the train to the matches and talked my friends into putting their kids on it too. I did this because of a belief I have said out loud to my wife many times. I did not want to raise protected kids in suburban Bellevue who would someday be handed the world like a cold plunge. The experience has to be there. So we build it deliberately over years. I took them on the local trains in Mumbai. I had my son walk the ghats of Banaras barefoot, because that is how that world is walked. In Sicily, a 90-year-old restaurateur in a hole in the wall yelled at my son in Italian for being on his phone during lunch. That scolding, in a language he didn't speak, from a man four generations his senior, taught him something no one in Bellevue was ever going to teach him. My daughter has walked Mount Etna, a live volcano. She watched the soles of another hiker's shoes start to burn. Wrong shoes, wrong spot. The heat invisible, until the guide laid a sheet of paper on the ground, and we watched it scorch. The world doesn't always announce where it's hot. She learned that on a mountain years before that Sunday. Once in Florida, February 2020. Spring break, weeks before the world shut down. We were driving back from Legoland and stopped for dinner at an Indian restaurant in a city we had never been to. Outside it, an unhoused man approached us. Everyone tensed. I did too. But by then, I had left 30 years of corporate life for homelessness work. And even those first 2 years had taught me the thing that world teaches you. Most of what looks like menace is a person asking to be treated as a person. I said, "I'm sorry. I'm not able to help you right now." I acknowledged him. I wished him well in finding what he was looking for. And the moment simply ended, the way moments do when someone feels seen. My kids watched that. That was the curriculum in all those years, on all those trains, in all those cities. Nothing bad ever happened to us. Not once. Here is a confession from 33 years of living in Bellevue. I never lived in Seattle, and I never stopped craving it. We are an East Side family. The suburbs raised my children. Good schools, quiet streets. A certain kind of safety that comes with a certain kind of sameness. And 10 miles west, across the lake, was the city. The noise, the water, the strangeness, the life. For most of those years, the distance wasn't really miles. It was parking. Anyone who has tried to take small children into Seattle knows the city guards itself with logistics. In 2018, I left corporate life and went to work on homelessness. I have now spent 8 years learning why people do things that don't make sense to us. And I want to be honest. I still don't know the full story, but I know more than I did. It changed how I read the city. Where my neighbors saw danger, I had learned to see people having the worst decade of their lives in public. So I walked my kids down Pike and Pine and 3rd Avenue, past the McDonald's on 3rd, the corner where, a few years back, a shooting left downtown Seattle, bleeding on the evening news. When Capitol Hill became Chaz, the self-declared autonomous zone the whole country argued about from their couches, soon renamed CHOP, I took my kids through it and explained what was happening there. And when a friend's son was stabbed in Capitol Hill, and my daughter, a teenager then, wanted to go to a concert right next to that spot, my wife and I talked it through, and she went with her friend and with her older brother alongside. But first, we told her what had happened there, and we showed her the exact place. That was always the method, not no, no. We walked these places on purpose, not recklessly. I'm their father, but deliberately. The way you take a child into deep water while holding their hand. I wanted them courageous. I wanted them perceptive. I wanted them to know what the world feels like so it could never ambush them with itself. And I should be honest about the suburb too, because the ledger has to balance. In May of 2020, while the country burned over George Floyd, organized looters hit Bellevue Square, Lincoln Square, and the Bravern. They smashed in and cleaned out dozens of stores. Blocks away, residents stood armed in front of their neighborhoods. The mayor declared an emergency, a curfew, a ban on weapons downtown. The governor sent 200 National Guard troops into the suburb where my kids had grown up, buying sneakers at that mall. Our children saw that. The safe side of the lake had already shown them that safety is a habit, not a place. And through all of it, I will say plainly, the Bellevue police were always there, and our experience with them has been fantastic. Meanwhile, my daughter's school went into lockdown 1 year because of a shooting threat. Her generation drills for this the way mine never drilled for anything. Our own police department has said publicly that an active shooter on the east side is not a matter of if, but when. The furniture of my children's childhood included this. We just didn't look at it directly. Then, the light rail finally crossed the lake, and the city I had craved for 33 years was suddenly a train ride away. I rode the 2 line the way some people break in a new guitar. Seattle to Bellevue on one of the first connections. Mercer Island. Judkins Park. Chinatown International District. I walked to the station every chance I got. I took my son. I took my daughter. Especially my daughter. Because she leaves for college in a few weeks. And this was the last summer of the curriculum. She is going out into the world. I wanted her to have already met it. Bellevue, to its credit, met the train seriously. The police stood up a dedicated light rail unit, officers riding the trains, walking the platforms and the garages. Seattle's department was stretched thin, and somebody had to mind the crossing. Whatever you think of the politics, the effect on one particular household was real. And here it is. My wife grew up in Delhi, and the story of women on Delhi's public transport is a whole book on its own. One I don't get to write, only to have had described to me. My Mumbai locale was safety, community, the city holding you. Her Delhi bus was the opposite. So she never had my affinity for trains, and she never owed me one. What she had was openness, one step at a time. And here is the arc I am proudest of, or was. Somewhere between the 2 lines first ride and this summer, the woman who grew up guarding herself on Delhi buses became a person who would stand in a crowd at the torchlight parade on a Saturday night in Seattle and ride the train home at 11 p.m. at ease. That was July 25th, the high water mark of a project years in the making. 19 hours later, we were running. It was supposed to be the great festival weekend of the summer. And for 2 days, it was. Friday, Derby, days in Redmond. My son brought a friend. My daughter's friend met us there. Swag, tchotchkes, a free fencing lesson, too much food. We were late getting there, actually. My daughter spent the afternoon driving one of her friends wherever she needed to go. Because that is who my daughter is. Remember that detail. It comes back. We had thought about starting the weekend with my mother along. She's past 80 now. Her balance isn't what it was. She and I talked it through and decided the festivals would be too much. She chose, in her own words, to be grateful for the activities she has. Remember that detail too. Saturday, the Chinatown International District Food Walk, restaurant to restaurant, a tray of fried tofu at 3:31. Then, at 3:50, the tea we didn't plan on. An ube brown sugar boba with creme brulee milk, purple over amber, ranked number one on the shop's own menu. And the kids would tell you, correctly. One of those days that assembles itself into happiness. Then, the torchlight parade on the waterfront. Color guards from every service, carrying the flags past Puget Sound. Classic cars idling by. And at 8:11, close enough to touch the car, the mayor of Seattle rolled past us in a white Seahawks cap, waving from the back of a convertible in the golden light. Then, the 11 p.m. train home. My wife, relaxed, in a Seattle crowd, at night. A fantastic day. Maybe the best proof yet that the whole project had worked. Sunday, the Bight of Seattle. Its last day. I had read that the Bight had changed. That the little local restaurants I remembered had given way to big traveling vendors and viral pop-ups that don't even have restaurants. Okay, I thought, let's go see for ourselves. We drove to the train station, and the 2 line was down past South Bellevue for scheduled maintenance with a bus bridge onward. My wife made the call. Take the car. It's easier. We may be back late. My daughter drove. Her friend, already at the festival, tipped us off that the Amazon garage is free on weekends. We parked and walked in. I have been going to Seattle Center for 33 years. Folklife, Bumbershoot, the Bight. It looked different. Not wrong, just enormous. Hundreds of thousands of people over the weekend. And it felt like most of them were there with us, under that gray sky. My phone kept the record of that afternoon. The way phones do. 4:17. Garlic noodles from a stand called Noodle Boys. We stopped there for no better reason than that it looked good. My daughter loved them. I asked the guys where we could buy these noodles some ordinary weeknight. San Francisco, they said. They travel. There's no restaurant. The old Bight would have handed me a business card and a reason to drive somewhere in November. The new Bight hands you a wonderful thing that exists nowhere. 4:24. Pupusas from Pupuseria Salvadoreña Natalie. A local place with a 206 number hand-lettered on the banner. Jalapeño and cheese. Bean and cheese curtido on the side. I talked to the owner. He does the South Lake Union and Fremont Farmers Markets. I made a note. My wife and I love taking the train to farmers markets. Now we had a reason and a destination. So the articles were half right. The viral circuit had arrived. But the old Bight, the small local business you discover and then follow home, was still in there. It fed my family 7 minutes after the new one did. Standing between those two stands, I had, without knowing it, mapped the whole argument of this episode. One of them you can find again on an ordinary Saturday. The other exists only in the crowd. 4:48. The kids get dirty sodas from a Utah stand. $8 drinks with paper umbrellas and cherries. 4:50. I take a video of them drinking those sodas on the lawn by the International Fountain, the Space Needle over their heads. 1,000 people on the grass. 5:00. A family picture by the fountain. The four of us, around 5:30, we came back in through Fisher Pavilion on one last hunt. Her friend had raved about a chili garlic noodle from a different stand entirely, and among 300 stalls, we could not find it. My son announced he needed the restroom, so my wife and both kids headed into the southwest entrance of the armory. My daughter said, "Come on over." I said, "You guys go. I'll wait outside. Call me when you're done." I didn't tell her why. The why was the mac and cheese balls she'd wanted and walked away from. 5:57. the photo, the text. O M H. They came out of the southwest corner of the armory. My daughter in front, my wife and son behind. I was maybe 15 or 20 steps away at the stand, talking to the cashier from California. My daughter spotted me and pointed me out to my son. Dad's over there. He broke into a run toward me, away from her and my wife. I never saw him coming. I had my phone out to pay. Then the pops. Multiple. To my right. At the northwest corner of the armory. The corner we had been about to walk toward. Up the armory road. Before a kid's bladder rewrote our route. I want to tell you I assessed the situation. What happened is that the entire world said run. And I ran. And somewhere in the first seconds of running, a small hand grabbed my right hand from behind. I didn't look down. I flipped my grip and took it and kept moving. And my whole thought complete was this. I don't know whose kid this is, but some kid is holding my hand and wants to get out of danger. So we ran, this child and I, west of Fisher. Pavilion, there are stairs. And the stairs were a stampede. People tripping, falling over each other. A crowd turning into a thing with no mind. I felt the hand in mine, and I slowed down. That, I actually decided. I am not going to fall with this kid. We took the stairs slowly, while the crowd broke around us like water. At the bottom, I stopped. My wife was there. My first thought was relief, and my second was arithmetic. She's here. Where's my son? Where's my daughter? I didn't see my daughter. Then I looked down at the child on the end of my arm. It was my son. I had run a quarter mile, holding my own boy's hand, and not known it. He looked up at me and said, "Dad, I'm scared. I'm scared. I'm scared. I'm scared." What I learned afterward is what my daughter did in those same 3 seconds. She saw me at the stand. "You were paying," she told me later. "You had your phone out, but you were looking the other way." She heard the shots and knew them for what they were. And she ran the family like a dispatcher. She told her brother, "Go grab Dad." She sent the boy with no phone and no watch to the one parent who was separated. She grabbed her mother's arm and pulled, saying, "Run, run, run. It's a shooting. A teenager. 3 seconds. Everyone assigned. Everyone moving." We went west on Lenny Wilkins Way, south on Warren, left on Denny. The sound of sirens converging behind us. A man near the garages, thinking we were arriving, warned us. "Don't go into the Seattle Center. They're shooting there. We are walking away from it," we told him. I steered us into a parking structure. Concrete, controlled entrances, hard for anything to follow. We stood there a moment among the cars, 4 people breathing. In the elevator, a woman mentioned she'd just finished her shift. "Did you come from the Seattle Center?" I asked. "No, just off work." "Did you know there was a shooting?" "Oh my God, no." 100 yards of concrete away, normal life was proceeding on schedule. That might be the single strangest thing I've ever felt. How thin the wall is, and how invisible from the other side. I stopped my family at one point on that walk and said, "Don't worry." Easy for me to say, I know. But I gave them my actual reasoning, out loud, like a lecture nobody enrolled in. The incident has happened. Hear the police pouring in. Everyone is on high alert now. Whoever did this is fleeing, not hunting. The farther we walk, the less risky this gets. It's what I had. My son wanted words. So I gave him what I had. We didn't know yet that it had been 2 people shooting at each other. A private war with a crowd for a backstop. In the moment, you assume the worst version. One shooter. Hunting. You do the math against your own children. Here is the record. Because a story like this owes its dead the facts. Just after 6 p.m. on Sunday, July the 26th, 2020, on the last day of the Bite of Seattle, a free festival that drew over 300,000 people, two gunmen exchanged fire outside the Seattle Center Armory. Seven people were shot. Three of them died. A 19-year-old man, a 44-year-old man, a 56-year-old woman. Among the wounded was a 2-year-old boy. Police, already on the grounds, ran toward the gunfire. The chief later said flatly that this prevented more deaths. One suspect, described as a young person, was arrested. As I record this, the other is still free. That evening, we saw the mayor on the news, standing at Seattle Center, calling it an unbelievable tragedy. 22 hours earlier, she had rolled past us at the parade, waving from the back of a convertible, close enough to touch the car. Same city, same woman, same distance from my family. One night in the golden light. The next, on the crime tape side of the story, we were now inside. Three families are planning funerals because their people stood at the wrong food stand. A toddler is in Harbor View. My family walked to a garage and drove home. The distance between those outcomes, as best I can measure it, was about 20 steps and one restroom break. My son had no phone and no watch. If my daughter had not seen me, if he had run into that crowd looking for me and the crowd had taken him, there was no way for him to find us. And I don't finish this sentence? That is the sentence I have been not finishing since Sunday. We were all in the same field when it happened. We have not been in the same weather since. My son needed to speak. I'm scared. I'm scared. In the moment. And then a steady stream after. The retelling. The questions. The wanting, it said out loud. My daughter needed the opposite. Let's get out. Let's leave. Let's go home. And then, for the rest of the evening, please don't talk about it. Please don't talk about it. My wife needed to process it in words, too. She and my son on one side of that line. My daughter, alone, on the other. And I did the thing I do, which I can now see from the outside. I analyzed. I narrated probabilities to my terrified family on a sidewalk. I am not sure whether that was for them or for me. Both, probably. It's how I hold a thing still enough to survive it. I rank none of these. Four nervous systems took the same 11 minutes and wrote four different stories. And every one of them is a correct response to gunfire. If you had told me on Saturday that my family contained this much difference, I would have nodded and understood nothing. Now I know it the way you know things that have been demonstrated. Even the drive home was a negotiation between the four weathers. My son wanted to talk. My daughter wanted silence. I wanted, and I realize how this sounds, to go back and find her those chili garlic noodles. Or failing that, the Chinatown place from Saturday. Because some stubborn thing in me wanted the day back. My wife wanted home. We compromised. On a Chinese restaurant in Kirkland, one suburb closer to home. A bit more safe is how it felt. We ate, we drove back. That meal, the negotiated, diminished, still together version of the day I'd planned. It might be the truest picture of what a family looks like an hour after. That night, two of my daughter's closest friends came over and sat with her for an hour. One brought Taco Bell, and the girl who had spent the evening saying, "Don't talk about it," came out of her room open, talking to everyone on her own terms. Her silence had lasted about 5 hours, and it ended not because her parents managed it, but because the people she chose showed up. The next morning, another friend arrived with coffee and a cheese sandwich for her and asked after all of us, "Here is the detail I asked you to remember. This is the same friend my daughter spent Friday afternoon driving around. The errand that made us late to Derby Days. I have spent years teaching my daughter the world. It turns out that while I was doing that, she was building her own. A web of people who show up within hours, bearing fast food and loyalty. My curriculum got her out of Seattle Center. Hers is what's bringing her back. There is a practice I try to live by. And its books must be kept, honestly. So, the ledger. Five things broke our way on Sunday. My son's restroom stop, which took us off the Armory Road minutes before it became a shooting gallery. My daughter's 3 seconds of perfect command. The small hand that found mine in a running crowd. The right hand, the right stranger, who was no stranger. The photo I texted at 5:57, which is the only reason she knew where to send him. And my mother, past 80, with her uncertain balance, safe at home, because a week earlier, she had weighed the festival weekend and chosen gratitude for the life she has. I have seen what those stairs did to steady adults. I will not say what they would have done to her. She already knows. When we talked about it, she was the calmest of us all. 5 coins landed heads. I'm grateful for each one. And I refuse to pretend the other side of each coin wasn't there all along. That is what the old words mean. The ones I keep close. You don't get to love, only the fate that flatters you. In the 2 days after, more than 150 messages arrived. Friends from all over the world who had seen Seattle and shooting in the same headline and thought of us. One friend, a college classmate from our India days, who has, like me, made America his home, reminded me gently that this is not an American monopoly. The day before the bite, the same weekend, police in Bihar fired on students protesting exam fraud. A 15-year-old boy took a bullet in the neck and lived. Students, a boy my son's age, plus a few years. Another friend in Massachusetts wrote the same thing in different words. The world has changed. It's not just America. Somewhere between Saiwan and Seattle Center, the idea that there is a safe country to raise children in, if you can just pick correctly, quietly died for me. Maybe the world itself has changed enough that my son is simply living in the world that is. He is growing up in it the way I grew up with Mumbai's trains. As the water he swims in, his school drills for this, his sister's school locked down for this. And now he has heard it live and held his father's hand through it and asked his questions and gotten what answers exist. We have reached out to counselors for the kids and for my wife and me. I want to say that plainly in public because I work in a field where I watch every day what happens when people carry things alone and call it strength. Asking for help is part of the practice. It goes in the ledger with the gratitude. Same column. In one of those message threads, writing to a friend at some raw hour, I typed a sentence I have been turning over ever since. After 37 years here, we finally paid the true cost of immigrating to America. I don't say it in anger. I say it as accounting. This country has given my family more than I could have drawn up on paper. The education, the work. The second career where I get to be of use. The daughter driving her friends around a safe suburb in a safe car. The son who has been to 4 continents. I'm grateful in a way that only immigrants fully understand. And this is also the place where a food festival can become a crime scene. Between the placing of an order and the paying for it, both things are the reality of the place I call home. Sunday was the day the second one stopped being an abstraction and put its hand in mine. So the question I can't put down is the one under everything I have said here. For 15 years, I took my children toward the world on purpose. The trains, the GATs, Third and Pine, the whole curriculum. I believed the experience has to be there. Then the world came to us. Shooting. Is it true? What I hoped? Is my daughter so perceptive, so protective, so instantly commanding in a crisis? Because I raised her against the grain of the suburb? I look at what she did in those 3 seconds, and I want to claim it. I look at her silent behind her door that night, and I wonder what the claim costs. Maybe I prepared her. Maybe she was always her, and I just gave her the practice field. A father doesn't get to know. He only gets to watch her friends bring her back to life with Taco Bell, and understand that whatever he built, she finished building herself. Viv gratia. Amor fati. Memento mori. Letitia Durabilis. Live with gratitude. Love your fate. All of it. The mac and cheese balls and the gunfire. Or you don't love fate. You love luck. Remember death, which was 20 steps away, and looking elsewhere. And build the kind of happiness that survives. Contact with the truth. Because the other kind just died at a food festival. The 2 line reopens after maintenance. It will run from Bellevue, across the lake, into the city I have craved for 33 years and taught my children not to fear. I don't yet know when we'll be back on it. Ask me next summer. This has been The Mosaic Mind. I'm Krishnan Iyer. Thank you for listening. And if your family has lived through something like this, talk to someone. It goes in the ledger with the gratitude. Same column.